In this mini lecture, we're going to look at insect reproduction. We'll look at morphology of the male and female reproductive system, and we'll talk about behavioural changes and physiological changes associated with feeding, nutrition and orientation that permit reproduction. And just touch on the importance of reproduction when considering the pest status of an insect. Then we'll look at some examples of mating, egg development, fertilisation, oviposition, primarily focusing on Drosophila melanogaster and an Australian example, the sheep blowfly Lucilia caprina. And lastly, we'll just touch on aggression because some of the genes that are expressed to set up the sex differences between males and females are also important in aggression amongst insects. I recommend that you review the mini lecture for BIOL2205 Insect Science Reproduction. There'll be a link to it on the resources. And this is a bit of a refresher. Let's have a look at the male reproductive system from the top down. Testes, vas deferens, a seminal vesicle where spermatozoa are stored, an ejaculatory duct, an intromittent organ, also called adiagus or penis, and a gonopore. The males have accessory glands associated with the reproductive system. Now on the right-hand side, let's look at female. Females have paired ovaries. They can vary a lot in shape depending on the degree of egg development and whether egg development is synchronous or asynchronous. Terminal filaments, ovarioles, where the developing eggs are moving down, calyx, lateral oviduct, spermathecal gland associated with the spermatheci. This example has a single spermatheca. We'll be looking at Diptera where there are multiple spermatheci, a median oviduct, female accessory glands, genital chamber, vulva. Sometimes this region is called the bursa copulatrix. Thinking about female egg development, there's many different strategies. Some insects lay huge numbers of eggs. Some lay them all at the same time in huge batches. Others lay sporadically. So you can see that, you can imagine the morphology of the reproductive system suits the reproductive status and the frequency and nature of egg laying. An important concept is whether female insects are autogenous or anautogenous. Autogenous, meaning self-developing. Autogenous insects, the females produce eggs without first feeding, particularly on protein. Many Lepidoptera fit this category where the caterpillars have taken in sufficient nutrient that the pupa is developing eggs, and then the female ecloses from the pupa, or the cocoon, she has developed eggs already in the ovaries. The other extreme is anautogeny, where females need to consume nutrients to develop the eggs. That's common in many flies. We look at it in Drosophila and Lucilia. It's also most common in mosquitoes because the female mosquitoes need to get a blood meal before they can develop their eggs. And anautogenous insects, there's a big onus on the female to detect resources. In autogenous insects, the onus is on the immature stages to find the appropriate resources. One Diptera and one fly I can think of that is autogenous are the glowworms, bioluminescent insects, where the larvae are very long-lived. The adults are very short-lived. They only live for a few days, whereas the larvae live for 6 to 12 months. So the adults don't have time to find resources to develop eggs. The eggs are developed when the female ecloses, and all she does is finds a mate and lays eggs. This is a side-on drawing of male and female reproductive system from Volker Hartenstein's booklet. These images are available online. And this is Drosophila melanogaster in particular. You can see the female at the top, uterus, accessory glands, Interestingly, in Drosophila, there's a bit of a tradition of calling the accessory glands parovaria, P-A-R-O-V-A-R-I-A, meaning next to the ovaries. But to be keep the terminology in common with most insects, I prefer to call them accessory glands. Spermatheci are paired, ovaries, oviducts. And you'll see this little structure, coiled tube structure called the seminal receptacle. That's quite specific to Drosophila and its relatives. It's an alternative sperm storage organ. Sperm are stored in the spermatheci as well as in the seminal receptacle in Drosophila. The male, the side on view, the testes are quite elongate and coiled. The paragonia, that's once again another yet another name for the accessory glands in the male. There's a lot of sort of taxon-specific names for reproductive structures. Ejaculatory duct, there's a sperm pump. You can see that in both, the reproductive system takes a considerable proportion of the abdomen. Male-female differences, it's very interesting and challenging developmental issue as to what is the difference between males and females, when and how is it set up. There's a lot of very recent advances being made in Drosophila studying the difference between male and female behavior and getting down to the level of understanding differences in individual neurons that are different between the two sexes and mediate different behaviors between the two sexes. If we go right back to the very early part of embryogenesis, the gene sex lethal is transcribed only in females. Now, in Drosophila and other flies, the sex determination mechanism is based on counting the number of sex chromosomes in relation to the number of autosomes. The 2X to 2A ratio produces females. They're XX on their sex chromosome. Males, on the other hand, are XY on their sex chromosome, so their ratio of X to the autosomes, the other chromosomes, is a half. So this is a mechanism for measuring dosage, and that determines then, that sets off the whole sex differentiation pathway through the gene sex lethal. So sex lethal is only transcribed in females on the left-hand side of the diagram. Now, it regulates transformer. And transformer is a gene that can be alternatively spliced. So in future females, you have two versions of TRA produced, TRA and TRA2, whereas in males, because the sex lethal ratio is different, only TRA2 is expressed. Let's look at females again, and from the combination of TRA and TRA2, two downstream genes are turned on, double sex and fruitless. Double sex, the female version of that protein, produces the female soma, soma meaning the body. So the sexual characteristics such as the reproductive tissues, some structures in the brain, etc., are female. Female nervous system and female behavior. Fruitless is produced a female version, but in very small amounts. If we look at the male side, double sex and fruitless produce male versions of those proteins, and they dictate the male body structures, the secondary sexual characteristics, as well as sexualize the brain. The nervous systems are quite different between males and females. Well, let's re-express that. They're actually very similar, but there's only a few thousand out of many hundreds of thousands of neurons that express fruitless, and they are very important for the difference between male and female behaviours. In the sensory system, males and females have different olfactory receptors and gustatory receptors, as well as some ionotropic receptors. That in general, they both have a very similar set of ORs, GRs and IRs, but there are just some sex-specific receptors that are different, and they're very important in detecting mates. In the brain, there are some neurons that express the male isoform, fruitless upper M there, and it's expressed in about 1,500 neurons of the many hundreds of thousands. In the abdominal ganglia, they're the regions that control the abdominal muscles, and if you think about it, the abdominal morphology is very different in males and females because that's where the reproductive system is located. And the abdominal ganglia are associated with controlling behaviours associated with mating, oviposition, selecting oviposition sites, etc. Males and females have different pheromones, so that's another area where fruitless and double sex come into play. The male pheromone is a cuticular hydrocarbon, so it doesn't have a high volatile component, but slightly volatile. It's called cis-vaginal acetate, CVA. It happens to be deposited onto females during mating. So it's a male pheromone, but when the male and female copulate, some of it gets onto the female, and that allows later males to discriminate virgin from mated females, because mated females will carry a little bit of the CVA from their earlier matings. Courtship in Drosophila has been studied in quite a lot of detail. It's complex. The female is more passive than the male in the whole mating courtship process. First, the male detects a potential mating partner, so he uses vision. Then he will use vision and olfaction to orient to a particular, to get him behind the female. He will tap her with his forelegs. That's where gustation comes into play, because the males have specific gustatory receptor hairs on their forelegs that the females don't have. So the male can taste the female. Then if the female stays relatively still, the male will then go into what's called singing, where he orients towards the front of the female and vibrates one wing. If you go online, you'll find recordings of the Drosophila courtship song. The actual sequence of buzzing by the male is species specific, and it's quite a specific song. If it's not right, the female won't want to mate. Then the male orients towards the rear of the female and tastes the female using his mouth parts. Gustation comes into play again, attempts copulation, and once the male mounts the male has special sex combs on his forelegs that help grasp the female's leading edge of her wing, and he's allowed to copulate. The diagram on the right side shows the sequence of some of the sensory inputs associated with mating. The emphasis here is that sensory inputs have a huge influence on whether mating will be successful or not, and whether an appropriate individual is being courted. Males will try to court other males, but they soon realise that they're not courting a female and they'll abandon the attempt. We've got vision in the early stages, olfaction in the early stages of orientation and tapping. Taste comes into play further down the courtship cascade. Mechanosensation is present throughout the cascade. So many different senses are involved in a successful courtship. Now, this slide, I don't expect you to remember the degree of information in here, but it's informative because it just tells us some of the sex differences and their role in sensory inputs in courtship. If we look at contact chemosensation on the bottom left here, the way these diagrams are arranged is that the colour is coded for sex, whereas on the very left-hand side, these are ligands or pheromones, cuticular hydrocarbons. If they're in red, they're on the male. If they're in blue, they're on the female. Sensed by a receptor, once again, if it's in red, it's on the female, sensed by the female. If it's in blue, it's sensed by the male. And the behaviour is shown in very briefly summarised on the right-hand side column of that box. One of the obvious things is that most of these receptors, the gustatory receptors, there's one ionotropic receptor, there's pickpocket, which is expressed in multi-terminal neurons. A lot more male-related specific contact chemosensation than there is female related. So it's sort of telling us that the onus is on the males to detect the females, because they've evolved many different receptors, all these gustatory receptors and behaviours associated with courtship that the females don't possess. But the females, obviously, they have compensatory or reciprocal interactions to choose males. And so the same concept is used for vision, visual cues, photoreceptors. It's not exactly known what behaviours are specific to the female. It is known that the female, if she's receptive to courtship, will slow down and will not try to move away while a male is courting her. So that could be one of the key things. A female detects a male in the courtship process, visually detects him and decides to slow down and allow him to continue. And for the male, there's a lot of approach. There's a lot of positioning relative to the female, from being in front of her to the side, and then coming behind the female to actually copulate. Auditory inputs are also important, because the female has to detect the male's courtship song, and that's species identification, intraspecific male choice. Olfaction. Similarly, there are olfactory receptors and ionotropic receptors associated with olfaction. CVA, cisphenol acetate, is the male pheromone, and you can see there are specific olfactory receptors. It does have a volatile component to it, so it is detected by olfactory receptors. I might have said earlier that it's only gustatory, but from this diagram it must be purely olfactory, and it modulates receptivity of the male and the female. I don't expect you to know the details of this slide, but it's the concepts behind it. The fruitless gene, there's an interesting story to the fruitless gene. It was discovered in a mutant analysis. Drosophila were mutated, and a line was found where the males were not very good at mating females, but they kept trying to mate with other males. This is just a little story. When it was first published, tried to be published, the lab that discovered its role in mating, and because the males were not very good at mating, and primarily because the males spent a lot of time trying to mate with other males, they called it fruity. The journal editors didn't like that, thought it was slightly derogatory, so they changed the name to fruitless, meaning less productive, and that name has stuck, so that's where it came from. Since it was discovered, its role has been figured out in a lot of detail. It's a key to sexual behavioural differences between males and females. And as I say here, the neural sex is just as important as the morphological sex. An insect can have the morphology of a male, morphology of a female, but if the brain and particular specific neurons in the brain have their sex changed, the degree of or the type of fruitless expression changed, then their behaviours will be that of the opposite sex. As I said, the fruitless mutants with a loss of function allele do not distinguish between male and female flies when courting. And when they're housed together, a whole bunch of males will form mating chains. And you can see in this photograph that the males, most of them have one wing out. They're trying to court the male in front of them, but another male is trying to court that one, and so on and so on. So you get this chain of males attempting to mate with each other when you have a container with just males in it. So let's look at what happens after a successful copulation. The diagram on the right shows the female reproductive system, labelled there. Seminal receptacle is purple, spermatheci there with a capsule, accessory glands, etc. Now, it was discovered pretty early on that females, once they were mated, their behaviour changed radically. First of all, they become refractory to further mating attempts. It doesn't last forever, because females lay eggs and are using up sperm. So they do return to receptivity, but this behavioural change associated with mating was fascinating. And by a bunch of different experimental methods, including transferring glands, but from a male from a male into a female. It was shown that there's something associated with the male accessory glands that turns off receptivity in the female. And it was discovered that there's a sex peptide produced in the male accessory glands that is then released with the sperm in the seminal fluid, and it is crucial in changing the female's behaviour. It's since been discovered that the sex peptide is a relatively short protein, 36 amino acids. It binds to sperm tails and it's gradually released from stored sperm within the female. As I said, the female stores sperm in the spermatheca as well as the seminal receptacle. The sex peptide is not just on the sperm tails. It can also just be released into the female's reproductive tract. And it's responsible for switching off her receptive behaviour, and it's also involved in turning on subsequent behaviours such as oviposition, sight-seeking behaviours. So the sex peptide has been studied in quite a lot of detail by a few labs. It was shown to bind to sites in the brain, the thoracico-abdominal ganglion, and the oviduct. And then further work showed that it's detected by a small number of sensory neurons in the female reproductive tract. This diagram here shows the location of these neurons. These neurons express pickpocket, which is expressed in many multi-terminal sensory neurons, if you think back to your sensory module. And some express different combinations. They're color-coded of fruitless double sex or both. And so these neurons are specific to females, obviously, because this is sex-specific, the female reproductive tract. They send their signals back up to the thoracic abdominal nervous system, to the abdominal component, and there are some fruitless expressing neurons that connect back down onto the oviduct. Some of them are interneurons, so they're integrating information within the abdominal ganglia, and some send messages up to the brain. So this is like the control center, part of the control center for reproductive behaviors in the female. And the female detects mating, obviously mechanical detection, mechanical sensory input indicates mating, but you can see that this is a much more specific receptor system for successful mating, where the female senses that she has received the sex peptide from the male and that sets her off onto a different train of behaviours. Her receptivity decreases and her oviposition increases. It's shown that mutant females that lack the sex peptide receptor, they can mate normally, but they remain receptive to mating after they have mated successfully. So they waste a lot of time undergoing a lot of mating. Let's look at sperm storage. Across insects, females usually have between 1 and 3 spermatheci. We're looking at Drosophila here, where there's a pair of spermatheci. Spermatheci are usually, usually lined with the sclerotized cuticle, and that's probably to protect sperm from UV radiation. And they're either surrounded by dermal glands, the spermatheci themselves, or they have an adjacent spermathecal gland. The image on the bottom right is an unstained spermatheca, and you can see the large glandular cells around the sclerotized brown cuticle, as well as you can see a duct. The duct is how the sperm get into the spermatheca and how they get out when the female needs to use them to fertilize eggs. The duct is actually quite muscular and it undergoes contractions as well. The scanning electron micrograph is the spermatheca of Drosophila was cleared in potassium hydroxide to remove tissue, leaving behind the sclerotized cuticle, which is that helmet shape, and those little objects on it are the end apparatus of the individual dermal glands that the gland cells themselves were removed by the caustic potassium hydroxide but the end apparatus remained, and you can see the very fine ducts that take the secretion into the lumen of the spermatheca, where the sperm are coiled, and they're still active within the female. They're swimming round and round in circles. If you crush a spermatheca taken from a dissected female, the sperm are released, and you can see they're very long tails, and they're quite active. There's been some work done in recent years on the role of the secretion from the spermatheca gland cells and the accessory glands, which sit just in posterior to the spermatheca. And using a Drosophila genetic technique, those cells could be killed so that you had females that were otherwise normal, but they had no gland cells associated with their spermatheca or accessory glands. And those females were able to mate okay. But it was found that the sperm did not get into the spermatheca in anywhere near the numbers they did in wild type. So the secretions of the glands around the spermatheca are required to help to get the spermatheca up there. We don't know whether that's female related, as in it's via, you know, uterine contractions, or is it related to the sperm needing that as a signal to be able to get to their correct location. Also, it's required to store sperm. Sperm show morphological abnormalities when there are no secretions. So there's some nutrient storage capability associated with that gland secretion. I mentioned before the sensory innervation of the female reproductive tract. There's also innervation from the thoracic abdominal ganglion. There are octopaminergic and tyraminergic neurons who send axons down, and they ramify. They have synapses on the muscles of the uterus and the oviducts. And they're very important in regulating oviposition. It's a complex process. First, you have to have ovulation, where an egg is released from the ovary, and then it has to move down the lateral oviduct, the common oviduct, and it lodges into the uterus or bursa. And that's where it's fertilized. Sperm are released, and they get into the egg. Really important part of reproduction and a very stereotyped behavior. And it seems that this octopaminergic and tyraminergic innervation is necessary for the release of sperm from the storage so that they can fertilize the eggs. And there are many roles for octopamine and tyramine. They're also involved in aggression and other behaviors, like motivation type behaviors and reward behaviors. So they're overriding neurosecretory neurons that we've mentioned in other parts of this course. In general, copulation is the genitalic morphology is very diverse, and there's, you know, the lock and key hypothesis, where the male and female reproductive systems have to match perfectly for optimal fertilization. But there's some degree of competition between males and females. The onus is on the female to select good males. The onus is on the male to inseminate as many females as possible. And so you get this some rather extreme sexual selection for genitalic morphology. One example is this Drosophila species that has extraordinarily long sperm, because that allows the sperm to carry more of the sex peptide into the female. I'll just now look at another species. It's interesting to take the comparative perspective, because there's so much work being done on Drosophila using the genetics approach and other tools available in Drosophila that many times people lose the perspective of looking at many insects. Lucilia coprina is the Australian sheep blowfly. It's a pest in the sheep industry, but it's also a household pest in Brisbane and a whole lot of northern part of Australia. Now, they are different to Drosophila in that they undergo synchronous ovarian development. So they lay eggs in batches. So they don't just deposit eggs through the day and night as Drosophila do. So the onus is on them, the female, to find an appropriate site. And it's usually something rotten meat. And she'll probe with her ovipositor and then make a decision to lay eggs, and then she'll lay over 200 eggs in a batch, and they'll hatch simultaneously. Now, the females have to have protein, so it can be more than a week after they are closed before they've found enough protein to develop all their eggs for their first egg batch. And in Lucilia, the females only become receptive after they've ingested protein. So the signalling system between males and females might be slightly different. Well, I'm sure it is, but the pheromones, the cuticular hydrocarbons will be different, obviously, because they're different species. But the whole mating scenario could be different because of this different habit of laying eggs in batches and the stronger need for a lot more protein to develop synchronously develop a whole batch of eggs in Lucilia. Interestingly, the amount of protein required for full receptivity is less than that required for oocyte maturation. So the females, if they have quite a bit of protein but not enough to develop their eggs, they'll say, yeah, it's time to mate because I can store the sperm, and by the time I'm ready to lay eggs, I will have mated so I can fertilise those eggs. The depletion of sperm in Lucilia during mating has been studied in some detail. And in a female that has recently been mated, it's been measured that about 3,000 sperm are deposited by the male inside the spermatheca. And the interesting thing, at each oviposition event, think about it, there's 200 or so eggs, 38% of the stored sperm is used. But the interesting thing is that if we look at the on the right-hand side of this diagram, while each egg batch is approximately the same size, the females use a constant proportion of the sperm for each egg batch. That doesn't make a lot of sense if we think that this egg fertilisation is optimised, because after a few oviposition events, there's fewer sperm per egg used up in fertilisation. It's only when the sperm stores drop below about 600 that the fertility of the batch reduces. So there seems to be an optimal number of sperm required for successful fertilisation, but that's only after multiple egg batches, and these are under experimental laboratory conditions, and they might not apply in the wild, but they're interesting because they're telling us that there are some mechanisms, unknown mechanisms, whereby females use a certain number of sperm per fertilisation event. Males can mate multiple times, 10 to 20 times per day. And experimental work found that after 8 or so sequential copulations, the number of sperm transferred begins to decrease. You can see that in the graph here. The number of sperm in the male mating number 1 is up around 5,000, and it rapidly drops, so that after 8 matings, there's less than 1,000 sperm being deposited. Now, these are all done in one day, and then if those depleted males were allowed to rest overnight and then allowed to mate again the next day, you can see that there had been some recovery of sperm production, but then they'd rapidly, once again, deplete their sperm. In Lucilia, as well as Drosophila, it's likely that the males have a sex peptide because they're relatively closely related diptera, and the morphology of the internal reproductive system is very similar. Males have accessory glands, and it's been shown experimentally that you can dissect the accessory glands from a male and put them inside the abdomen of a female in an operation, and that immediately makes that female non-receptive. So it's very highly likely they have a sex peptide, though it hasn't been identified to date. And as you might remember, Lucilia has a complex mechanism for injecting accessory gland fluid or material into the female's reproductive tract, and so that also supports this idea that the sex peptide has to be pumped into the female in a specific location. The males have these barbed adiagus or penis that they use these lateral barbs to tear a hole in the female of the cutic, of the female's reproductive tract, where she has these special thick cuticular pads, and he injects the accessory gland fluid there. So it seems like a reservoir in the female to prevent her from mating again. Another interesting topic that comes up on looking at Drosophila is that aggression is closely linked to the sex determination pathway. So I'll talk here, I know it's not reproduction, but it's aggression. But they are related, so I'll talk here about it. Now, aggression is used by most animals to gain access to resources such as territory, food, and mates. Males will compete to get access to a female, and Drosophila will do that. You can see these photos show some of the experimental setups where a female has been, I think on the right-hand side, the female's been glued to the top of that arena, and there are two males fighting over access to that female. There's a number of online videos showing this aggressive behaviour between male and female Drosophila. And people have used macro video to analyse the behaviours associated with aggression. And they've broken them down into charging, tussling, wing threat, where the males raise both wings, boxing, where they use their front legs to go at each other, fencing, lunging, headbutting. So even something as simple as a tiny little fruit fly has some complex aggressive behaviours. The interesting thing is that both sexes show aggressive behaviour, but it's different between the males and the females. In males, it's motivated primarily by securing mates and territory. In females, it's for protecting food and oviposition resources. Males show more territorial aggression patterns. We see many, many species where the males are territorial. And they engage in higher intensity components of fights. Females, it's more a hierarchical relationship. Lower intensity and shorter aggressive bouts. And the next slide shows, I don't expect you to remember the details of this, but it shows the sequence of behaviours and the cycles of particular behaviours that females and males go through. The point of this slide is to show that there are gender-specific behavioural patterns. The males show wing flicking, whereas the females don't. So there are some male or female-specific components of their behaviours. And these are all related to the fruitless gene. The sex of some neurons in the brain then determine the motor patterns that are available, whether it's a male or a female, that then produce different types of interactions, behavioural outputs. And if you change the sex of the brain by experimentally expressing fruitless in female brains, where females normally don't express fruitless, or you prevent expression in male brains, where there's three forms of the protein, but you can knock out all of those. Now, all you're doing is changing fruitless expression in a very small subset of neurons, 1,500 or so neurons. But that leads to the animal using the behaviours, aggressive behaviours of the opposite sex. So if you prevent expression in male brains, they'll interact with other individuals and show this female-specific behaviours, whereas females will show male-specific behaviours when you express fruitless in their brain. So it just shows the importance of this very small set of genes in determining reproductive behaviour as well as aggression, because aggression is reproductive-related behaviour in most cases. I'll stop there.